So kind of an odd topic for a meditation group tonight. I'm going to talk a little about the Christian season of Lent. Lent begins on Wednesday, when 2 days from now is Ash Wednesday, which is the beginning of Lent. And traditionally, in the Christian sense, Lent is a time of repentance, time of remembering how sinful one was and repenting in preparation for Easter. And of course, Easter is really the most important holiday in Christianity. It's the holiday commemorating the foundational event of Christianity, the resurrection of Christ. Now, for those who are not part of the Christian belief system, of course, this idea of sin, it can be hard to relate to this idea. So I'm going to reframe it slightly. We can think about Lent as a time to reflect on questions around, does my life reflect me? Do the choices I make in my everyday life reflect who I am in my higher self? Am I showing up in the world in a way that I'd like to be showing up? In doing the things that I do every day, am I becoming a person that I want to become? Mm-hmm. And really, there's a lot that's appropriate about this time of year for this. We're moving into the spring. And of course, in a few months, it's hard to imagine now with all the rain and the cold and everything, but a few months, it's going to be warm, it's going to be bright. You know, right now, everyone's bundled up in jackets, you know, except for those maniacs that wear shorts all the time. But in a few months, everyone's going to be out and about, and we're going to be... It's really a time when people are seen more, both literally, but also just in a variety of ways. We're seen more. We tend to be a little more isolated in the winter time. And so it's almost as preparation for moving toward this time when we're going to be seen more. It's this very natural time where we kind of take stock of our life and take stock of where we are, how authentically we are living our lives. Lent is 40 days. And in fact, an odd thing that some people don't know about Lent, it's starting from Wednesday, it will be 40 days, but not counting the Sundays. The Sundays don't technically count as part of Lent. In fact, if you give up something for Lent, you're allowed to have it on the Sundays during Lent. But why 40 days? Well, 40 is an important number in the Bible. Of course, in the story of Noah and the flood, it rained for 40 days and 40 nights. The Israelites wandered in the desert for 40 years before they were allowed to enter the Promised Land. And then in the New Testament, we're told of this fast that Jesus undertook. And so I'll give you sort of the synopsis of this Bible story. This is from the Gospel of Matthew. Jesus had just been baptized by John the Baptist, and it said the Spirit of God led him out to the desert, and he fasted for 40 days and 40 nights. And then Satan appeared and gave him three temptations. And the first temptation was, well, you're so hungry, change these stones into bread. Do that by your miraculous powers. And Jesus refutes him by quoting Torah, by quoting the scriptures, and says, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God. Then Satan takes him up on a mountain where he can see all the kingdoms of the world and says, bow down and worship me. I'll give you power over all the world. And Jesus again refutes him by quoting Torah. You know, you shall worship only the Lord thy God. And then, very interesting, takes him to the top of the temple and says, well, you know, you're so spiritual, throw yourself off the top of the temple. The angels will just catch you, you know. And again, he quotes Satan. He quotes Torah and says, you shall not put the Lord thy God to the test. And then after these three temptations, Satan apparently kind of gives up, and then the angels take care of him. And so I find those three temptations fascinating. The first temptation, change the stones into bread, the temptation of hunger. Hunger is something innate in us. Hunger has been shaped by evolution. In fact, it's been shaped throughout mammals. You know, all mammals get hungry, you know, and so this is something that's been shaped for, you know, hundreds of millions of years, our experience of hunger. We have no doubt when we're hungry. It's an innate feeling. But at the other end, when we've had enough to eat, the feeling of satiety, that's very, very subtle. And it's very easy to overshoot that. You know, if we're talking or the food is good, it's very easy to, you know, completely overshoot enough and then we've eaten too much. You know, it's a very human experience. You just have to go to any restaurant and finish what's on your plate and you will have eaten too much. Mm-hmm. So satiety can be learned. It's a skill that can be cultivated, so it can be learned. So hunger is innate, but satiety has to be learned. And that relationship between innate versus learned, that's true not only of physical hunger, but that same relationship is true of all our emotional hungers. Our hunger for attention, our hunger for approval, all these sorts of things, our hunger for security. We're keenly aware when we're not getting enough. But that whole balance area, when am I getting enough and when am I getting too much? You know, we're not necessarily very good at that. It takes a lot of skill to negotiate those boundaries. And so one whole set of questions about am I living from integrity? Am I living a life that is aligned with who I really am? To what extent are my hungers pulling me away from whom I really am? You know? And I'm going to guess that probably no one here is you know, deals chronically with physical hunger. But to what extent are my emotional hungers? To what extent am I looking for attention in a way that pulls me away from where I am? Am I looking for approval in a way that pulls me away from where I am? This sort of thing. So there's sort of one set of questions around hunger. The second temptation, you know, control over the world, give you power over the world. And so everything around control. You know, what's our relationship to control? What sorts of things are we trying to control that really we can't control, you know? You know, and what's our relationship with power? There's the kind of power that is very healthy that comes from within, resting in one's own power. And then there's the kind of power that's kind of pervert, like trying to have power over other people and manipulate other people into doing what we want. And so there's a whole set of questions around that. To what extent does my relationship to power or my relationship to control pull me away from my center, pull me away from who I want to be? The third temptation is you could kind of, you know, go up on the temple and throw yourself down and let the angels catch you. You could almost call this the temptation of being too spiritual. And so part of this is, it's what Choyang Trungpa called spiritual materialism. You know, in other words, we meditate or we do whatever spiritual practice we have, And then we start to feel good about ourselves. And then we start to develop this attitude of, look at me, look how spiritual I am, you know? And of course, that's the complete opposite of what spirituality is about. Spirituality is about this self-surrender and self-forgetting and offering to others. But this funny way that ego wants to turn everything to its own advantage, you know? And the way that that itself can be a block for our deeper growth, our deeper unfolding. Another part of this temptation, I would say, is all the ways that we use the word should about ourselves. You know, all the internalized moral codes that someone else forced upon us, you know, in early childhood or whatever, and then we're living out this moral code. You know, I should be this way. I should be doing this kinds of things. You know, I should be this kind of person, not that kind of person. And to what extent this internal should is pulling us away from who we are. Now, it's fascinating, in the Christian Bible, Jesus encounters these three temptations at this critical moment in the narrative. He has that experience in the desert, and then he goes and he starts gathering disciples. Buddha also experienced three temptations in the classical story. When he sat beneath the Bo tree, and his three temptations that he faced was the temptation of pleasure, the temptation of fear or aversion, and the temptation of social duty. And so those are also an interesting lens to look at. To what extent does my experience of pleasure pull me away from my center? This is a hard one for us Americans to get, because in America, we all have, like, there's this, how to say it, there's this buzz of Puritanism that's always in the conversation around any kind of pleasure, you know, and Puritanism has this message that pleasure is bad, and if you're enjoying yourself, you must be doing something wrong, and this sort of thing. And Buddhism doesn't condemn pleasure of any sort at all. It's perfectly fine. But are you enjoying it, or is it running you, you know? Is it something that you're just open to and allowing to pass? Or are you holding on to it and being pulled away from who you are? That's the problem of pleasure in Buddhism. To what extent do fear and aversion, pushing things away, to what extent do these pull us away from the kind of person we want to be? You know, to what extent does fear prevent you from showing up in the world the way you want to show up? You know, that's a very important inquiry. And it's a funny thing about fear. It's very anti-intuitive. Often one of the greatest antidotes to fear is just looking very carefully at what you're afraid of. You know, especially if it's an inner fear, just examining it very carefully and almost getting curious about it. You know, what is it? What is it really that I'm afraid of? What is the worst that could happen? You know, in parts of the world where they have tigers, it's very funny that it's conventional wisdom. Of course, if you're in the jungle and you run into a tiger, the worst thing you can do is turn and run away. If you turn and run away, you're prey, and the tiger will eat you. Your best chance of survival is to stare the tiger down. Because the eye-to-eye confrontation, that's not predator-prey. Like, you're not predator. You're not prey if you're staring the tiger down. Now, if the tiger's really hungry, he might eat you anyway. But the point is, that's your best chance of survival. So much so that in those parts of the world where there's tigers in the jungle, they'll have false eyes that they wear like as jewelry on the back of their heads. So even if a tiger appears behind them, they see eyes. You know? the way to face all the internal fears is to look at them carefully. If you run away from your fear, internally you're becoming prey. You know? Prey is what runs away from fear. And finally, social duty, which is very closely connected to what I was talking about a few minutes ago, the shoulds. And it's a tricky one because we find our meaning in connection with others. And, you know, it's not that there's anything wrong with connecting with others and honoring family relationships and honoring friendships and all this. But to what extent does my sense of, you know, being connected to others and what others expect of me pull me out of who I am, pull me out of alignment with myself? And the truth is, if I'm not in alignment with myself, I don't have the best of myself to offer to anyone else anyway. I'm going to read a couple passages of poetry. Both of these passages are from Mr. T.S. Eliot, who had quite a bit to say on subjects of Lent and this sort of thing. This is from a poem of his called The Hollow Men. So I'll pass this out in a minute, but I'll read it first. Eyes I dare not meet in dreams, in death's dream kingdom, these do not appear. There the eyes are sunlight on a broken column. There's a tree swinging, and voices in the wind singing, more distant and more solemn than a fading star. Let me be no nearer in death's dream kingdom. Let me also wear such deliberate disguises, rat coats, crow skin, cross staves in a field, behaving as the wind behaves, no nearer. Not that final meeting in the twilight kingdom. What I find powerful about that passage, it's about the prospect of being deeply seen. Like the powerful gaze that deeply sees you. And it's this very human thing, because we all kind of want to be seen, but it also freaks us out. Like, you know, I remember someone showing me this kind of gesture. Like, that's the typical human relationship to being seen. Like, yes, but no. You know, that kind of thing. And this whole idea of wearing disguises, like, all the disguises we wear and the masks we put on so that we don't have to risk being seen. The other passage is from a poem by T.S. Eliot called Ash Wednesday. Suffer us not to mock ourselves with falsehoods. Teach us to care and not to care. Teach us to sit still, even among the rocks, our peace and his will, even among the rocks. Sister, mother, and spirit of the river, spirit of the sea, suffer me not to be separated, and let my cry come unto thee. And I love just the balance in that. Teach us to care and not to care, you know. So I'll pass out the quote sheet at this point. You can read the poems a little more if you like. Kind of service. So after the poems, a quote from St. John Chrysostom. Chrysostom means golden tongue. He's one of the greatest preachers of all time. And he's considered one of the three great patriarchs in the Eastern Orthodox Church. And he wrote, no act of virtue can be great if it is not followed by advantage for others. So no matter how much time you spend fasting, no matter how much you sleep on a hard floor and eat ashes and sigh continually, if you do no good to others, you can do nothing great. And I like that, the whole idea of, you know, are the sacrifices I'm making in my spiritual path Are these actually making me a more loving person? Or is it actually benefiting other people? From St. Elphin. Lent is the time of our lives when we are most especially called to reflect on our lives and ask ourselves, how much do we thirst for an intimate relationship with our loving Jesus, who is waiting for us to respond to his love? It is the time that we must ponder deeply how much we thirst for a life that is life-giving to others. I love that image. How much do we thirst for a life that is life-giving to others? St. Catherine of Siena simply said, nothing great is achieved without much enduring. St. Francis de Sales said, have patience with all things, but first of all, with yourself. I love that one. From Parahamsa Yogananda, this is from the autobiography of a yogi, he said, his guru, Sri Yukteswar, used to poke gentle fun at the commonly inadequate conceptions of renunciation. A beggar cannot renounce wealth, the master would say. If a man laments, my business has failed, my wife has left me, I will renounce all and enter a monastery. To what worldly sacrifice is he referring? He did not renounce wealth or love. They renounced him. Saints like Gandhi, on the other hand, have not only made tangible material sacrifices, but also the more difficult renunciation of the selfish motive and private goal, merging their inmost being in the stream of humanity as a whole. And this whole idea that we can't really give something up until we own it, you know? And this paradox that we really have to step into our own personal power in order to give up our ego. From Catherine Doherty, there are ways of being crucified that do not involve rough wood and heavy nails, but a love beyond our capacity to love, which means a love that has been given to us by God. And so I love that idea of a love so deep, it's, as it were, a love that hurts because it's so deep, that kind of compassion. From the great Jewish scholar, Abraham Joshua Heschel, the focus of prayer is not the self. It is the momentary disregard of our personal concerns, the absence of self-centered thoughts, which constitutes the art of prayer. Feeling becomes prayer in the moment in which we forget ourselves and become aware of God. Thus, in beseeching him for bread, there is one instant at least in which our mind is directed neither to food nor to hunger, but to his mercy. That instant is prayer. We start with our personal concern and live to feel the utmost. For Father Thomas Keating, Lent is a time to renew wherever we are in that process that I call divine therapy. It's a time to look at what our instinctual needs are, look at what the dynamics of our unconscious are. The author Tom Robbins says, the key to self-generated happiness, the only reliable kind, is the refusal to take oneself too seriously. I love this one from the current Pope, Pope Francis. God never tires of forgiving us. We're the ones who tire of seeking his mercy. From Bishop Morneau, Lent is a season when we have the opportunity to step back and look at our past choices and what we are presently choosing. In the end, choices are quite limited. Life or death, God's will or our own. And there are so many ways that our choices are quite limited. And Karen Armstrong says, we are the greatest spiritual writers and sisters, most fully ourselves when we give ourselves away. And it is egotism that holds us back from the transcendent experience that has been called God, Nirvana, Brahma, or the Tao. What I realize now from my study of the different religion traditions is that the disciplined attempt to go beyond the ego brings about a state of ecstasy. It is itself ecstasis. Theologians of all great faith have devised all kinds of myths to show that this type of kenosis or self-emptying is to be found in the life of God itself. They do not do this because it sounds edifying, but because it is the way that human nature seems to work. We are our most creative and sense possibilities that transcend our ordinary experience when we leave ourselves behind.